Good morning and welcome to Jew in the City Speaks with your host Allison Josephs, also known as Jew in the City. This war in Israel has been rough the entire time. It's obviously been rough on the side of the losses of the people on October 7th, on the side of soldiers who have died, on the side of injuries of the soldiers, emotional trauma, displaced Israelis who are getting pummeled with rockets from the north. But then there is another type of pain and trauma involved in the experience, which is the accusations of Jews as warmongers, bloodthirsty baby killers. War is never a good thing. It's never a nice thing. But sometimes wars are just wars because they're wars of self-defense. They're wars of existential existence. And that's what Israel is fighting right now. And there is a book that came out recently that my husband got that, as far as I know, it was written before this all came out, but I guess this issue has been relevant for some time. It's actually written by a guy that we knew back in college. He is the first cousin of one of my husband's and my good college friends. His name is Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Brody. He is the executive director of Ematai, an organization dedicated to Jews navigating the dilemmas of end-of-life care. He's a columnist for the Jerusalem Post, an award-winning author of A Guide to the Complex. His most recent book, Ethics of Our Fathers, A Jewish View on War and Mentality, was released in January. Ethics of Our Fighters? Ethics of Our Fighters, right?
Ethics of Our Fighters, yes, indeed.
Okay, fine. Ethics of Our Fighters. So, Rabbi Brody, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to see you.
Yeah, great to see you as well. So, you know, what I was so happy when my husband got this book was that I think this is exactly what we need to review right now as a people, because as far as I understand, the IDF makes its decisions in part by Jewish law. Obviously, you know, Israel is not a theocracy, but it's a democracy that uses Judaism to as a worldview, as a lens. Am I correct in stating that?
Well, I'd say that the IDF's ethics are developed largely based on general philosophy and international law, but certainly the impact of Israeli culture that's created by Judaism is very real, and Jewish ethics certainly play a role in the overall way that Jews and Israelis think about fighting.
You know, one of the interesting things that happened early on in, you know, when we were started to be accused, and we really have to just call it blood libels, because although it's not lies about Jews stealing Christian babies and putting their blood in our matzah, the accusations of Jews targeting babies, targeting innocents, you know, because we love wanton violence, is the same thing. Early on in the war, when there was the blood libel about the Israel striking the hospital in Gaza on purpose as a target, one of my friends, who is a proud Reform Jew, not very knowledgeable, but certainly she knows her people, she said to me frantically, "Did we do it?" And I said to her, "I don't think so. And even if we, God forbid, did, it was an accident. It was an errant missile. We don't strike innocents. We don't strike civilians or hospitals as our goal." And I said to her, "Just think about who our people are. You know our people. You know that we are people that love, you know, justice and life. And, you know, this is who we are. So you don't have to be the most learned person. You don't need to be the most religious person. But if you know the Jewish people, you know that we value life as one of the holiest things that there is. And so we don't target innocent life as a mission." So, yeah, with that sort of intro, why did you write this book? When did you write this book? And kind of what has the response been since October 7th?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely correct. I mean, we don't target non-combatants. We certainly don't want to strike hospitals and innocents. And, you know, this is one of the things I was trying to do with the book, which, as you guessed, I started writing well before October 7th. I want to try to lay out a sort of a view of how Judaism thinks about these issues. I think many people fear the impact of religion in general when it comes to military ethics, because they assume religion equals fundamentalism. And part of what I want to try to show in the book is how Judaism has been understood throughout the centuries and certainly over the last 100 years by rabbis and others thinking about these questions, understands the importance of balancing values, understands that we go to war sometimes, unfortunately, to defend ourselves. But at the same time, we want to have restraints and ethical restraints, and we want to have a framework of thinking about these deep ethical dilemmas. And certainly one of the most obvious things and clearest things that people said from a religious perspective is that we do not want to harm non-combatants. We want to avoid as much as possible harming those who aren't trying to harm us, whether it's babies and children or whatever it might be, or people in the hospital. That's certainly not our goal. And so I think you're right that in many ways, there's a certain type of blood libel out there that assumes that the Jewish state must have this element of vengeance or must have this element of being bloodthirsty. And it's a horrible thing. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to develop a real framework of thinking about how Jews should look at these ethical dilemmas.
You know, the interesting thing is that Jews are kind of accused of having the sort of vengeful testament. The Old Testament is the vengeful God. The New Testament is, you know, the God of love, turning the other cheek. Historically speaking, it was Christians that went out and, you know, had the Crusades, had these, you know, holy wars. Muslims did as well. Sometimes you see people make these broad statements that, you know, religion leads to war and all wars are caused of religion, you know, are caused by religion. But that's true of these larger religions historically, although we have to note that, you know, a lot of the Christian community has been deep allies to the Jewish community, and certainly we have moderate Muslim allies as well. But in terms of the more radical elements and in terms of the past, Judaism never had that type of role. Can you talk about sort of the types of wars that Jews were engaged in compared to, you know, is that anything that you touch in your book, sort of like our historical wars?
Absolutely. And I think that one of the real dilemmas that comes up is you're right. You know, Christians and Muslims did engage in warfare. Sometimes it was quite bloody, sometimes quite bloody against Jews in particular. Other times they did develop a just war and an ethical theory about how to restrain warfare. And Jews didn't have to deal with this for many centuries, unfortunately, because we didn't have this power, right? We didn't have an army. And we suffered because of that. And part of the dilemma that emerges in the 20th century, as Jews return to the land of Israel, as Jews begin to fight also in Western armies, is this question about what Judaism has to say on this topic. And in this respect, I think that we don't have that long history of deep violence that you find in other religions. And therefore, this was in many ways an opportunity for us to introduce a refined vision of nationalism and a refined vision of religion that can help show the balancing of values and how you fight a just war.
I know a lot of Judeo-Christian law is based on, or I would say Western law is based on Judeo-Christian values, which is ultimately Jewish values as Christianity came out of Judaism. Would you say that sort of the laws of war, the international laws of war, could be traced back to also some Jewish ethics, Jewish laws?
Well, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I discuss in the book as well that you see certain times, particularly in the 16th and 17th centuries, when people start to try to develop in the West ideas of what just war looks like, they look to the Bible many times for certain sources of inspiration. I think one of the biggest sources of inspiration here is this idea that all human beings were created in the image of God, which places restraints on what we try to do to others because we believe that in one form or another, we are all alike. And this is a very important, you know, element to always remember. But the Bible also teaches us sometimes that you need to fight a war in order to remove evil, particularly evil from your midst. This is a moral imperative. And so, you know, I think that you get a multi-valued, I guess, background you get from the Bible and from the Jewish tradition here, which is something I think we should bring to the table today and understand that there is such a thing as evil. And particularly when it's a clear and present danger and going after you, you need to fight it. The West doesn't have to deal with this issue as much as we think. And the reason is simply because most Western countries haven't fought wars in many, many years, and they certainly haven't felt a threat on their own land. So it's very easy to sort of say, oh, Israel, look what you're doing, when you don't have to deal with that threat and those issues the way that Israel does. And I think that's part of why the West, in some ways, is reacting the way it does today.
Well, also, they're not looking at their own casualties of war that happened in the not so recent past. I mean, if you look into how many civilians were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, what the U.S. did in Japan with the nukes there, somehow, you know, the standard has changed, which leads me, I guess, to my next question or topic. How do we balance out, you know, the civilian casualties that are sort of part of war, accidentally with no intention? How does Judaism, if every life has value and you're going after, you know, enemy combatants, what do you do when there are, innocent civilians, especially from Hamas, being placed in those places specifically to try to increase the death count?
Well, the issue of comparing, like you said, to some of the hypocritical, criticism we're getting when you want to compare it to Dresden or Japan or other types of incidents in the past is certainly true. I would say that technology has changed today, and the ways that we can fight war have changed today. And therefore, I don't know if that's always the greatest comparison, but there's no doubt when you compare it to Iraq and Afghanistan, there's a certain amount of hypocrisy, particularly when the U.S. and Britain and others were fighting wars that were very, very far from their borders. And there's no doubt that when we fight war, we want to minimize what's known as collateral damage, right? The unintended harm that's caused to civilians. And one of the things that we have to ask always when we fight is, well, in a given situation, a given attack, in a given battle, a given raid, is the perceived military advantage proportionate to the amount of collateral damage that's going to be caused? And so we wouldn't like bomb an entire village in order to kill some one, sniper or fighter, or whoever it might be, who's not that great of a threat given the amount of collateral damage that will be caused. But there are many times when you have a fighter or a group of fighters who are placed in an area around non-combatants, and you have to ask, okay, well, given the threat they represent, given what they have done and are doing and will do if we do not eliminate that threat, is this a justified attack? And in many, many cases, the answer is yes. And the collateral damage, of course, is tragic. And for that reason, many times Israel doesn't shoot. And we see this from drone footage where we hold back sometimes because we're afraid that there are too many non-combatants in the area. But at the end of the day, the responsibility for much of the collateral damage, particularly in this war, lies on Hamas. I mean, there's a moral imperative on Hamas's side, which says that they should be trying to minimize the harm on their own civilians. And obviously, Hamas does the exact opposite. And when they're doing that, moral responsibility for those deaths lies with them. And I think this is something that, if you actually look in the sophisticated writings of the British Army and the American Army, when they write about the ethics of war, they admit this and they say when the other side is using human shields, moral responsibility lies with them. That doesn't mean we would always shoot, even if they're not playing by the rules of the game, so to speak. But when push comes to shove and we have a real military target and threat that needs to be eliminated, we need to shoot and destroy that threat because otherwise they're going to be coming after us.
Now, Israel, as far as I know, is the only country in the world that sends out leaflets to warn people to leave. They make phone calls. They, intercept television programs to tell people to leave. Is there a basis of warning civilians to get out of the way somewhere in Jewish sources, or is that just kind of a modern way of, taking a Jewish value and, trying to make it actionable?
So this notion of forewarning, of trying to tell people, listen, clear out of the area, actually appears in an early rabbinic source. It's one of the stories I tell in the book of this idea of saying that even when you're in the midst of war, in the case of the rabbis we're speaking about, in the midst of a siege, you should still try to allow people to evacuate. You should allow people to get out of the way of harm's way. The modern version of this is an element of forewarning, which we try to do with these leaflets. And by the way, Israeli army invented many of these tactics, but they've been modeled by other armies, including the US Army, which utilized it in Iraq and Afghanistan, and said, okay, wow, the Israelis have experience with dealing with these issues, and we can learn from the Israelis on how to balance these goals. And so Israel's done that a lot, and we should appreciate the fact that it comes with a price. Because if you forewarn and tell people, listen, the attack's coming in this neighborhood or this building, well, of course, non-combatants can flee, but sometimes combatants will flee as well. But Israel has decided that price is worth making, right? That step is worth taking in order to minimize the non-combatants being killed. And so I think that's a deeply Jewish value that we've tried to implement in this war. And it's rather unfortunate that much of the world isn't seeing how far we're going and the steps we're taking in order to do what we can to avoid that collateral damage.
Totally. Super frustrating to do the right thing and still be called bloodthirsty baby killers. What about the issue of captives, of hostages? This is obviously a topic that Jews know far too well. And I know that hostages, captives are written about as far back as the Talmud, and rabbis had to grapple with how that's handled. Any, sort of anecdotes or sources that you can pull out and, from the hostage topic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're right. This dilemma is long known in Jewish sources, and the rabbis placed a great premium on bringing home captives, on redeeming captives. But they also stated that in the name of what we call tikkun olam, that's the word they actually use there, the name of repairing the world for good governance, we have to sometimes place limits on the steps we're going to take in order to make sure that we don't give an incentive for others to take captives. And I think that's part of the dilemma we're facing today. On the one hand, we very much want to bring home these captives. They are our brothers and sisters. We also feel a certain responsibility for what happened October 7th. The fact that they were taken captive obviously was a failure of our own security, and we feel more responsibility to bring these people home. At the same time, what we've learned over the last 30 years when Israel's made repeated deals along these lines is the terrorists that we release in order to bring home captives almost always go back to committing terror and, in fact, become leaders of the terrorist organization. We know this from Hezbollah. We know this from the founder of Hamas. We know this right now. Sinwar, right, the head, the mastermind of the October 7th massacre, was released in the Gilad Shalit deal several years ago. So there's a real dilemma here on how to balance those goals. I think that reasonable people can disagree here on how far we should go on this issue. But I think there's no doubt that we do believe that there is an imperative to bring home our brothers and sisters who are in captivity. Ultimately, by the way, and this is one of the things that really frustrates me, is the world is convinced that Israel just has to offer a ceasefire or something else in order to bring them home. When in fact, this in my mind is actually the bigger issue, and the world just takes it for granted. Oh yeah, of course they're going to release 1,000 terrorists who have blood on their hands. What a horrible thing. I mean, this is a horrible thing that Israel is being asked to do, and maybe that's the right decision, but certainly people should recognize that comes with a real long-term security risk.
And not only did we release Sinwar, we also cured his cancer. So we had two ways we contributed to the mastermind of October 7th, having the wherewithal to do these heinous acts. Do we define enemies in different levels? Is there the enemy that comes in and just wants to take our land versus the enemy that comes in and wants to completely annihilate us? Is there any, sort of different treatment about sort of how hard we go in depending on the intentions of the enemy?
Well, I think we always have to make an assessment of what's the risk here, what's the level of threat. It's not just their intent, it's also what they're capable of doing. I think over the last several years, we've had small incursions into Gaza, we've had small wars or operations with Gaza, and the feeling was is that we could push them back, so to speak, and do some form of minimal incursion, and that would be sufficient to create a deterrent. And on October 7th, I think we saw that that was wrong, meaning ultimately it might be true in the short term, but the long term, vicious terrorist groups who continue to build up their capabilities and who say very clearly that their intent is to kill Jews. Right? This has nothing to do with the so-called occupation or anything along those lines. Hamas makes very clear in their charter and elsewhere that their goal is to destroy the Jewish people and to kill Jews in the land of Israel. And that being the case, we should take that seriously. And when they shoot and they shoot rockets at us, we can't tolerate this. And so, I think that when you're dealing with a significant threat, you have to deal with it in a proper manner and not just do it in a haphazard or half-hearted way. And I think, Allison, the big question that we're going to have to deal with is how to deal not just with Hamas in the south, but also with Hezbollah in the north, coming from southern Lebanon. I mean, here you have a situation where you don't want to go to war, right? We're not looking for this war. This would be a bloody war. Hezbollah is actually much more powerful than Hamas is. But at the same time, you have this moral imperative to allow people in the north to live in peace and without fear of having rockets shot on them or terrorist raids into our territory. And it could be that we get to the point in which we say we already have a sort of a low-level war with Hezbollah, but we might get to the point where we say we have to go in full throttle in order to push back or eliminate that threat. That's going to be a very, very difficult decision to make. But when that decision is made, if it is made, I think it has a great moral justification to doing it.
What about the idea? I know this is a thing that's come up in Jewish history, and I came up when I saw Golda, the movie that came out recently. This notion of Israel striking first when we see that the other side is preparing war against us. You know, I guess probably ideally in war, you don't want to be the side that strikes first, but if the other side is preparing for war and preparing for some big hit on the Jewish people, you know, is it the opinion within Jewish sources to say strike them before they strike you if you have good reason to believe that you're about to be harmed very
Yeah,
badly?
there's a notion in Jewish law that says rise up and strike first. If you know that they are imminently coming to attack you, there's no obligation to wait to take the first punch or take the first shot before you respond. Sometimes it's military at a military level, much more advantageous to take the first shot and try to eliminate the threat early on. That's, of course, what Israel did in the Six-Day War. That certainly has a rabbinic source and precedent for that. And unfortunately, it was probably the mistake we made in 1973 when we had a situation where on the morning of Yom Kippur, we already understood that an attack was imminent. And the decision made then was, well, we shouldn't attack first because it'll harm us in the eyes of the world or with the US and whatnot. And I think on a moral level, if we believe that a attacking first would have helped us, then we had a moral imperative to strike first and deal with the diplomatic repercussions later on. It was a terrible phenomenon that we didn't strike because we were afraid that Kissinger and others wouldn't give support to us. Of course, we have to care about our diplomatic strength and our ties and support that we have throughout the world. But when push comes to shove, you don't wait to be hit before you strike. You strike first. And that's a moral imperative, which I think we accomplished in 67, didn't accomplish in 73. And I think one of the things we're going to have to ask ourselves after October 7th is, how come we didn't attack Hamas on a more serious level first? Right? Is it because we just had a bad intelligence and didn't understand what the threat was, which is possible? Or it's also possible that we just didn't want to do it, attack them first. And that was a moral mistake. And we don't want to repeat that mistake again, specifically when it comes to Hezbollah or for that matter with Iran.
You know, I'm thinking about they have so many slogans on the other side, catchier slogans than we have. When people are occupied, resistance is justified. You know, I'm thinking about in Mitzrayim, in Egypt, when we were enslaved. And, you know, I mean, the examples I would say are very different. But if we want to even go along their line of thinking, we didn't even like fight against the Egyptians who were literally holding us bondage for 210 years. You know, God fought our battle for us. Is there any notion that, and I'm assuming the answer is no, but anything where, you know, if someone is, I don't know, anything along the lines of what they are claiming in these slogans that when people are occupied, resistance is justified?
Well, there is a notion of a just rebellion when you feel that you're being, you know, taken advantage of or being enslaved, whatever it might be, that we certainly have in Jewish law. And that's actually what the Zionists did in 1947, 1948. We launched a rebellion, partly against the British, although we pushed the British for our leaving. But we did fight a war of independence, which we believe to be just and true. In this case, however, given the fact that we're not occupying Gaza, we're not there anymore. We haven't been there for some years. And moreover, Israel's made many overtures already since the 30s, the 1930s, in terms of dividing the land and offering peace and coming out with some form of peaceful settlement. It's not justified to launch armed resistance when you have a much better alternative available to you. And in this case, I think that we've seen from many Palestinian terrorist groups that their goal is not a two-state solution. Their goal is to clear the Jewish people from the river to the sea. And when they're going to behave that way, and I'm not saying that is indicative of all Palestinians, their attitude, and certainly not of all Arabs, you know, there's certainly those living in the land of Israel or around the world, whatever it might be. But when you have a threat of those groups which govern the areas that we have to deal with, and particularly now Hamas and Gaza, you have to take that threat seriously. And so as long as they think that they can fight us and win, they're never going to give up that battle. And that's why it's such a moral imperative for us to push back against Hamas right now and to defeat this threat so that it will be understood that if you think that you have an option of destroying the Jewish people, you're wrong and you and your people are going to suffer because of that. Now, that's why it's so important for us to finish the job as we think that we can finish it. Of course, that doesn't mean you don't always stop fighting. Sometimes you stop fighting because you think it's not worth it, or you think you've accomplished enough, or whatever it might be. There's always that equation question you have to ask. But on a general level, as long as there's another side that thinks and acts this way, that they can attack you and destroy you, you have to push back against that threat.
Final topic, final question. We have a few minutes left. Do you talk about sort of what the truce looks like at the end? I know in World War II, which you said is not the best example, the goal was to basically bring Japan to their knees and, kind of say uncle, and then, we stopped. So, like, what does that look like in terms of, kind of making the enemy no longer powerful enough to become a threat and then moving on to the next stage of peace or truce?
Well, I think you want to get to the point here where you feel that they don't feel that there's a purpose, an advantage to fighting against us. But you also want to get to the point where you feel that you can create some form of better situation. I don't think anyone right now is really thinking, certainly those here that live in Israel, that there's going to be some two-state solution, tomorrow after a ceasefire. I think this is actually sort of like this Western imaginative idea right now. It's really divorced from reality on the ground. No one in Israel, including in the left-wing parties, is really speaking about this because they realize we have to defeat the threat against us. But in the long term, we want to have a situation where we can have a ceasefire and we can live at some form of level of peace with one another. And in that respect, of course, you have to ask yourself at some point, it might pay to stop fighting in order to preserve that option as we move forward. And that's going to be a careful balance. And Jews, as a peace-loving people, are always going to keep that in mind. And that's why I believe it to be the case that we'll fight as long as we think it's necessary to eliminate this clear and present threat. But beyond that, we're not going to fight because we want to hold out, a vision for a better day tomorrow.
All right, well, that's a very poignant way to end, and I think we are all holding out hope for some better days ahead. But in the meantime, our soldiers need to keep fighting, and hopefully, with minimal, casualties of innocence. And we'll just keep praying for peace and Mashiach in the meantime.
We keep on praying, but in the meantime, we have to have a moral resilience that allows us to keep on fighting to get done what needs to be done.
I mean, all right. Well, thank you so much. You can check out Ethics of the Fighters by Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Brody to get more in-depth look into this discussion about the ethics behind Jewish wars in Torah sources and applying to modern times. Thanks so much for your work in this subject, and may we hear good news.
Amen.
And thanks so much for listening. You can catch us same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.